This is an ABC podcast.
While all eyes are on the footy finals this weekend, we're going to head to Australia's most remote league in Central Australia. The APY Lands League has returned after tackling a spate of violent behaviour.
It felt as though they've had a big loss in the community. What Wimley did, we went away and we sat down with our whole community and said, we need to stop this stuff, all this violence and garbage, really.
And kids learning about Indigenous culture in the oldest classroom in the world.
We can see that one. It would have been potentially one of its pectoral bones for its front flippers. It's very old, you can tell. It's very brittle on the inside. This could well be a bone that's been taken from a harvested fur seal in this area with these seal hides here.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide. As thousands flock to the Melbourne Cricket Ground for the AFL Finals, 2,000 k's away, players are preparing for a football experience with a difference. This is footy in the APY lands of Central Australia, Australia's most remote outback league. Last year, the league was cancelled because of match day violence, but the league is back on this year after consultation with local communities and the development of a code of conduct. Patrick Martin hit the road to drive the hundreds of Ks on the bus to gather up the excited players for game day.
Humming through the streets of Mimalee in South Australia's APY lands, this bus heralds the start of a football experience with a difference. For Mimalee Blues Football Club captain Zibian Fielding, it's time to get moving.
This is just the real outback football league, you know. You can't get any remote than here in the APY lands.
Today, the team is travelling 230 kilometres to play against the Central Swans at Armitage.
It takes, you know, a fair few hours just to round up the boys in the community, trying to pick them up and ensuring that they got their boots and their whatnots.
Each week, 10 teams travel hundreds of kilometres on corrugated dirt roads to play the sport they love. Mimalee Blues defender Mark Campbell says they wouldn't have it any other way.
It got its own culture, footy does, as we do as well. And we sort of mix it up and it works. It's a really good combination how we do it with the team.
Reflections on how far the country's most remote Australian Rules Football League has come are never far away, after it was cancelled last year due to match day violence.
It felt as though they've had a big loss in the community. What Mimalee did, we went away and we sat down with our whole community and said, we need to stop this stuff, all this violence and garbage, really.
The long road to redemption is taken with renewed excitement.
Everyone's got that camaraderie and that spirit back in their own community, because Mimalee certainly has it. We got our new bus this year and the lads do get around each other and enjoy, I guess, the build-up during the week.
After a long day, Armitage is almost in sight, but there's one last stop. Before settling in for a night behind enemy lines, dinner is on the cards.
Yeah, making sure all of our players are fed so they can play strong and hard tomorrow. Kangaroo tails, one of the best things to have.
With dinner cooked, it's back on the bus for a feed and the final stretch. The buzz of game day at Armitage marks the competition's return. League organiser Sean Ford says its importance can't be underestimated.
The competition was founded back in 2006. The program was really founded as part of the petrol sniffing strategy to counteract a lot of the behaviour that was going on there around the entire APY lands. And then we've really just grown it from a 5-team competition through to a 10-team competition in both football and softball.
He says a new code of conduct developed with local communities has had strong results.
Every game has gone ahead with the exception of guys who have been unable to travel due to vehicle issues or whatever it might be, which is a common occurrence out here. From that point of view, we couldn't be happier.
Mark Campbell says with the footy back, there's only one goal in mind.
We've always been getting into the prelim. The ultimate goal is to make it all the way to the end, to the finals and finishing it. I'm going to make sure I'm not going to let it go this year.
With 80% of men on the APY lands between the age of 17 and 35 playing football, it's much more than a sport.
It is really good for these young people. It keeps them busy, you know, get out of mischief and also keep them occupied and, you know, with us, where we can keep an eye on them and, you know, talk to them and keep on mentoring them.
It's a fast and furious start. Amata gets the early break. Mimile fights back as supporters watch on, and at the last change, Mimile turns to senior players for inspiration.
We learn from our elders and pass on to our young ones. It's the same, you know, same thing, but in a different way, and just footy.
Scores tighten as the final siren nears, but the Blues go down by 7 points. It's a disappointing result, but unlike last year, there's always next week.
It gets really serious. We're getting better at it, so it doesn't start any more violence. We've been doing good this year. All the teams have been doing good this year. And win or lose, we're always happy.
Mimile footballer Mark Campbell ending that story from Patrick Martin. And you can see more on this story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30, or you can always catch it on iView.
ABC Australia Wide.
I think it's wonderful. I think everyone should come and see it.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. A foul-smelling oasis in outback Australia is providing a crucial refuelling stop for migratory birds born in the Arctic Circle. Birds from Mongolia, Western Alaska and Siberia are relying on the sewage ponds of Alice Springs in Central Australia to survive a 13,000-kilometre journey across what's known as the East Asia Australasian Flyaway, or Flyway rather. Reporter Alex Barwick headed down to the sewage ponds.
2 million migratory shorebirds visit Australia every year, and most of the 37 species are under threat. Lisa Nunn from BirdLife Central Australia says this makes artificial wetlands like these sewage ponds in Alice Springs increasingly important for birds that fly over the desert.
When they arrive in Australia, their reserves are really depleted and the birds are really skinny, and often they're really on the cusp of life and death at that point.
The sewage ponds are considered a biological hazard to humans, but a lifeline to these feathered friends who spend most of their lives chasing an endless summer.
They want to avoid winter. They come down here for our summer and then they go back to the northern latitudes for their brief summer there as well.
The parents fly first, leaving their 8-week-old offspring to fly alone. Ms Nunn says this is an enormous feat, given the young fly solo to Australia.
The journey itself is incredibly taxing on the body. When they've been feeding, their digestive organs are all enlarged so they can take in as much food as possible. And then when they go to leave, they shrink and their heart expands.
Birdwatchers from all over the world flock to the Alice Springs sewage ponds to witness the international birds' pit stop.
So some of the birds that we've seen this morning are wood sandpipers, common sandpipers, sharp-tailed sandpipers.
The birds feed on tiny invertebrates in the nutrient-rich waters.
Most of them will stop halfway to refuel. By the time they leave the Arctic, they've packed on, they've eaten so much that about 55% of their body is fat. And they'll burn that at an extraordinary rate. They'll fly, they might fly 3 days non-stop. They'll stop in Eastern Asia and then they're quite skinny by that time, and they'll then build up those fat reserves again to make it the rest of the way to Australia.
The sewage ponds also provide a vital permanent water source for local native birds.
Yeah, we've seen a definite decline this year in the amount of bird life that we're seeing out bush. And so a lot of birds have started to come into town just because there's so little food and water out bush.
Despite the dangers of these wastewater treatment ponds to humans, Ms Nunn says they present no harm to the birds.
It doesn't seem to have done them any harm by now. We've had a few migratory birds that have overwintered here for several years, so I assume that it's working out for them very well.
Alex Barwick reporting there from Alice Springs.
ABC Australia Wide.
How do the farmers feel about the price they're getting?
Absolutely stoked.
On ABC Radio.
Look after your skin. That's the urgent message for people living in the country from Australia's leading dermatologist. The incidence of melanoma is highest in regional Australia, and Dr. Claire Tate spends much of her career working in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. She says too often she sees skin cancers that could have been treated if detected earlier.
It really depends what population we're talking about up there. But in the Aboriginal communities, we see a lot of skin infections. And so we see bacterial infections, we see fungal infections, we see parasite infections. And we see a lot of what we call autoimmune disease. So there's a genetic predisposition to develop these conditions. And they are very troublesome and long-term conditions. So they require long-term management. In the predominantly Caucasian population, we see a huge number of skin cancers. And the first time I went up to the Kimberley to do a clinic, I was completely shocked by the number of skin cancers on each patient. So it wasn't just one patient coming with one skin cancer. It was maybe one patient who had 12 skin cancers, or 8 or 16, or, you know, it really was, to me, it was just extraordinary. And that was because they hadn't been able to access services for a number of reasons.
And what were those reasons?
So, opportunity to see a specialist, an understanding that they had something that it was really important to treat in a timely manner. So sometimes it was, well, I decided I'd get it sorted when it started to be a real issue for me. But with skin cancer, early timely diagnosis is absolutely key. So we don't want people to wait until it's a problem. We want people to say, oh, something's changing. Maybe I should just get it checked. Because we know that early diagnosis in skin cancer completely transforms the patient's prognosis and outlook from cure to perhaps a really life-threatening condition.
Can telehealth help at all with
this? Absolutely, yes. I'm really glad you asked about that, because in an ideal world, we would all be doing face-to-face consultations, and that isn't practical at the moment, and it's unlikely to be practical into the future. So we are very keen to develop teledermatology resources and proper teledermatology service across the country, but particularly I'm interested in doing it in this state. One of the difficulties is that the most telemedicine is done through video conferencing, which is very appropriate for most types of medicine, but it is not, unfortunately, good enough for dermatology because the quality of images is poor on video conferencing. So we have another method that we prefer to use called store and forward, which is whereby the local health provider can fill out a pro forma with all the relevant information about the patient and then take very good digital photographs just on their phone. They're quite good enough, but they're significantly higher quality than video resolution. And then send them to a dermatologist who can asynchronously at a different time, when it suits them, when they've got time, access the clinical information and the photographs and then communicate back to that primary health care provider what they think the issue is.
I suppose, though, you need to get over that hurdle of someone presenting and going, look, I've got six things that don't look that great on my skin. Can you check that out and ask their doctor to check that out? So that's your first hurdle, someone going, actually, it's not bleeding or anything, so I don't think there's anything that bad.
That's right, yes. So what and that's exactly right. It requires our patients to present to somebody, preferably their local GP. GPs are absolutely central in the healthcare of patients, and most country doctors are fantastic. They have a huge range of skills and knowledge, and they do need to go and see their GP first, and that has to be the first port of call.
Dr. Claire Tate, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks very much, Sinead. It's been a pleasure.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Taking children on country adds a sense of place to learning about Indigenous heritage that can't be captured in the classroom. With that in mind, the principal of Burnie Primary School decided to take his grade 4 children to King's Run in the far northwest of Tasmania. Now, King's Run itself has an interesting history. For 100 years, it was a cattle run, and the owner, cattleman turned environmentalist Jeff King, spent the last 20 years of his life protecting the King's Run Indigenous heritage sites from four-wheel drivers. When Mr. King passed away in 2017, the area was then sold to the Aboriginal Land Council of Tasmania as per his wishes. Now, King's Run is a place that preserves Indigenous culture and has also become one of the oldest classrooms in the world. Rick Eaves reports.
Orange is a good colour to look for spondylite. Spondylite was the extremely sharp type of cutting tool that I was talking about with you guys. But then we put him back exactly where we find him.
Hi, Andrew Starrick. I'm the principal at Burnie Primary School. Today we're learning from the oldest classroom in the world. There's one thing to learn about Aboriginal culture and history, but there's another to bring them out on country and to learn from Aboriginal people. Like most things, I was just talking to the kids just then about, you know, they were learning about abalone shells, for example, but to actually have one in your hand and to experience it, that's when the learning happens.
And you can actually hear and smell the Southern Ocean from here as well.
That's absolutely
got to enhance the experience.
Definitely. But having Jai here today has been a game changer for us. An Aboriginal Discovery Ranger working with Parks.
And you're taking the kids to the King's Run property today and to Premagana, the mountain. It must be a great addition to the experience of learning down here to have access to that King's Run property.
Absolutely. We've been fortunate to have developed relationships with a number of different people within Aboriginal communities, deeply significant places, and it's really hard to describe until you get down there. A very spiritual place, and to be able to share that with the kids is an amazing learning experience that a lot of adults will never get the opportunity to do.
Another seal bone, beautiful job. We can see that one. It would have been potentially one of its pectoral bones for its front flippers. It's very old, you can tell. It's very brittle on the inside. This could well be a bone that's been taken from a harvested fur seal in this area with these seal hides here.
G'day, my name's Jai Croswell. It's been an absolute privilege having a group of kids here from Ernie Primary creating our very own kelp basket. It really is amazing seeing the seal hides, so seeing the indentations within rocks on this coastline, which we use as ambush sites for hunting seals, as well as temmas, hut depressions left behind by the indigenous people living in the area, as well as extensive middens. So we're seeing all the different types of marine resources harvested by indigenous people over generations in this area.
What could that be from?
That there is the outside. You can just see the stripes of our warana, commonly known as periwinkles. Nice big one. You see, we can find another one just
there. Can I ask you your name?
I'm Parisa.
Grade 4?
Yes.
Yeah? What are you going to do with your kelp basket?
I'm giving it to my mum.
Oh, lovely. What do you think she'll do with it?
Her jewelleries.
Be lovely for jewellery, wouldn't it?
Yes.
It's got jewels on it already, hasn't it, with the shells?
Yeah.
Natural jewellery.
Yes.
How'd your kelp basket go?
Good.
What are you going to do with it?
Use it. I might put some, like, stuff in it and hang it, like, above my bed.
Tell me, what's your name?
Jackson.
Good job. It looks fantastic.
Thank you.
It has some lovely shells on it, and it's not quite done yet.
Not quite done yet. Plenty of time.
Yeah.
It's a very old craft, that.
Yeah.
My name's Jared Edwards. We're currently standing at Premagana, which is on the northwest coast of Tasmania, about 10 kilometres north of Murrawar. It's an area of land that was returned to the Aboriginal community in the late 90s. And it's one of the most culturally rich and sensitive areas that you could find on Earth. Premagana is one of those places that's got a lot of stories to tell about the old people. It's got the marks that they left behind in the sandstone rocks up on the end of the beach. It's got some of the most rare plant species in the world that you'll find, like the Crispedia premagana is only located here. I suppose I'm very fortunate in that I've had the opportunity as an Aboriginal person to live on and care for premagana. It's a place that our community holds dear to their hearts, especially Northwest Coast community members and also community members from all around the state and around Australia. Every year we congregate here for one long weekend in March and just spend 4 or 5 days practicing culture, catching up. And I think this year there was about 250 people, and it's an absolutely empowering thing.
And the kids here at Arthur River before heading off have had the chance to hold and look at ochre and flint tools. Hands-on is another great way to learn, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You watch, these kelp baskets will go back home and they will start stories with parents around what they've been learning as well. It's an experience that we weren't privy to. Aboriginal culture and history wasn't necessarily given great exposure when I was at school, for example.
And a bonus nature lesson today when the bus driver found a leech. It was fear and joy and...
All part of the experience, yeah. Couldn't have planned it better, really.
Look, I think the biggest thing for us as Aboriginal people when we bring children onto country, Aboriginal kids or non-Aboriginal kids, is that connection to country that Aboriginal people have with places like this, but also a sense of ownership that everyone should take away from this. Lutruwita, or Tasmania, belongs to everyone, and if everyone can take away a sense of ownership and pride in that story, it helps us as Aboriginal people preserve it and protect it for many, many generations to come.
Our reporter Rick Eves there visiting one of the world's oldest classrooms. It's King's Run in Tasmania, and it's possibly one of the windiest as well. What happens when you take one tiny country town with a population of 500 and put on a free music festival for 20,000? Well, Lucindale, in the South Australia's southeast, is about to find out. Tomorrow, it will be the smallest town yet to host Triple J's massive one-night stand concert. Thousands of people have begun flooding into the township to see headline acts such as Hilltop Hoods and Ocean Alley. Selena Green spoke to the organising committee member Kate Rayner.
How can I put this into words? I can't tell you how I'm feeling right now. It's a very surreal experience. I'm somewhere up in the clouds up there somewhere, and I am so proud of our little tiny town because this community has just been amazing. We've got a big party tomorrow night, so I just can't wait. When we had that big announce happening, I felt that there was like a big lightning bolt went straight bang into the town of Lucindale and people were shell-shocked. They were saying, what has just happened, Kate? And I said, well, we've just got this big event coming. And they were unsure at first about how and what they needed to do, but the community have just rallied around us and have got on board and, yeah, they've just been behind us all the way.
The big question now is how many people are going to show up?
I think we just have to roll with it and see what happens. Hilltop Hoods, how amazing are they? Ocean Alley and Meg Mac and G Flip, well, they've got an amazing pool. And I think South Australia, Victoria, wherever you're coming from, Perth maybe, even Darwin, I think they're all wanting to come and have a look. And, you know, the Triple J One Night Stand is an amazing event. It's a drug and alcohol-free event, but it's enabling families to come along. So I'm getting messages through the booking site, through the Facebook site, all about how excited these families are coming. They're bringing their 8-year-olds, they're bringing their 11-year-olds, because these they haven't had a chance to be able to bring children to an event like this, and they feel that they are able to do that. So we are so looking forward to having everyone come here, and we're welcoming you. Lucindale's welcoming you, everybody, to our big country town, or little town, actually.
Peter Corrigan and his wife, Kim, are the site managers at Yucca Park, where festival goers will be parking and camping over the coming days. Peter's also the president of the local Lions Club, which runs the region's largest field days on this site each year.
You know, we know our crowd builds up, you know, around 10 to 15,000 up to 25,000 for field day. So this is a little bit unknown for us. But we're ready. We're really ready to go. So, yeah, it's exciting. My Lions guys and everybody have worked tirelessly behind me and supported us so that we could get it all up and going. So we've been very lucky that we've got a young group that's helped my older Lions, because I think they look at Lions clubs as they're all old sausage sizzlers and things like that. But no, we've been really, really wrapped with the town support, you know, and the young ones have really got behind us, and that's what we want, you know, and we need them.
And what is making Saturday even more special for this tiny town is that its football club is fielding A-grade teams in both the netball and football grand finals tomorrow. The teams are having to use the local bowling club for their post-game events tomorrow, since their footy oval is being taken up by thousands of people attending a concert. Club president Aaron Smart says they've just had to roll with the punches since finding out that the one-night stand coincided with the weekend's big football grand final.
Initially, when it was announced, we first asked if we could change the date, but at that stage we had a whole heap of injuries and we'd lost four games and we weren't travelling along that well, so we thought, we were probably lucky to even make finals. So, we got the players back. We ended up finishing second, and then to go in the grand final, and you start thinking, geez, we've got another thing on the 14th, so it's going to be a big weekend for Lucindale.
Coincidentally, St Helens, last year's host of One Night Stand, won a football premiership on the same day that it held the concert. Are locals seeing this as a bit of an omen?
Yeah, well, the Triple J staff were taking a lot of claim and responsibility for that. Told them they've got to keep it quiet, otherwise every country town in Australia will be trying to get Triple J to come so they could be the omen of winning a flag.
Jeff Robinson and his wife run the local post office, and he's also the president of the local economic group. He's got a bunch of volunteers running a pop-up grocery store in the main street.
Been full on the last two weeks, but we've had a lot of support from community members. And as you can see here today, there's a good roster of people ready to check you out. We're open at, I think, 8 tomorrow, and we just stay open until people don't need our services anymore.
And as for the concert itself, well, Jeff thinks it's unlikely that he's going to make it there.
Wednesday was my 70th birthday, and my feet haven't touched the ground yet, so the family's coming down from Adelaide. We're having a party sometime Saturday night. And if the local football team win, well, you might see me mid next week.
That's Jeff Robinson ending Selena Green's report from Lucendale. And One Night Stand will be broadcast from midday on Triple J tomorrow. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.